Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the neck and neck elections between Labour and the Conservatives in the UK that are a week away, and we'll first play excerpts of an interview that the establishment politician Labour leader Ed Miliband did with the counterculture anti-establishment citizen journalist Russell Brand. Since Brand's main message to his millions of followers amongst the disaffected youth of Britain is that there is no point in voting because the financial elite and their political lackeys have rigged the system, it is worth contrasting the Brand-Miliband political debate with the highly orchestrated, shallow and antiseptic exchanges between our press and our politicians that we will be subjected to from now until the elections in November of 2016. Then we will speak with Toby Miller, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. He is a professor of media and culture studies at the University of Cardiff in the UK, and we will discuss the role of alternative media in the British elections that has resulted in an extraordinary upsurge for the Green Party due to their wildly popular video that spoofs boy bands and pale male politicians, and whether the small parties like the Greens, the right-wing UKIP party, and the Scottish National Party will determine which party next rules Britannia. Then finally, we'll examine the shake-up at the top of Saudi Arabia's ruling family and speak with an expert on the House of Saud, Robert Lacey, a British historian and author whose latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. Let's now go to the interview between Russell Brand and Ed Miliband, which is at the Trews, T-R-E-W-S, Russell Brand's website.
Hello, welcome to the Trews. Politics Week continues. We've already done the Lib Dems and UKIP, haven't we? Today it's the turn of Labour. You know from the papers and that. Ed Miliband came round here, you know, from that photo and all that kind of stuff. So let's see what happened when I spoke to Ed Miliband about the forthcoming election, about Labour and what we should do as a country. For me, what I've learned is, like, sort of, because of geopolitical influences, because of global finances, it seems that it's very difficult at a domestic level to leverage serious influence. So when we have a party,
it's just not true.
So you are in a position to confront these powerful organisations, the financial industry, transnational corporations.
Can I just put it in a particular way to you, right? Which you may not like.
Well, it's better for me to put it in your language, to put it in my language, because if you can understand me, it's better.
Okay, fine.
Right. Say for example, right, like the, you know, sort of average UK worker pays 20% normal like tax, right? Sure. Amazon paid 0.05% of 4 billion sales.
Yeah, we've got to
do we have the power to do that?
Of course you do.
How?
Well, first of all, you've got to do it internationally.
Yeah.
Because these companies are mobile around the world, and that is hard yards, but you've got to do it. And secondly, you've got to be willing to act on your own where you can. Look, there are different countries that have different ways of dealing with these things. Some are more successful than others. So of course there are ways to do it, to deal with it. It doesn't mean it's easy. In a world where capital and companies are mobile, of course you can deal with these things. And of course people share your outrage about companies that don't pay their taxes, and it can be dealt with. But you've got to have a government that is willing to say there's something wrong with this and we're going to deal with it.
You're that government?
Yeah.
Now, I know you've had a bit of a scrap with Rupert Murdoch before. There's no love lost between me and him. Like, I've said this before to politicians. What if it, like, you know, and I hope it doesn't sound adolescent, but what it feels like to us is, like,
sure it won't.
If Rupert Murdoch has this kind of power, this kind of media voice, if you are like the Prime Minister of Britain, can't you just go, right, I'm Prime Minister now, we're passing some legislation that means that monopolies are going to be significantly broken up. So Rupert Murdoch, it's been great, but now you can only own 10% or 15% of total media. Is that kind of thing a possibility? Because people want it.
We said in our manifesto you've got to look at these issues of media ownership and all that. And you know, I've spoken out against Rupert Murdoch on phone hacking and what happened to ordinary members of the public who were victims of phone hacking and, you know, intrusion and all of those things. The thing I'd say to you, though, about this, these people are less powerful than they used to be.
Yeah, I get that.
They're less powerful than they used to be.
They're still a bit too powerful.
Yeah, look, media ownership really matters. It's something I care about. As I say, we've set out in our manifesto that we're going to definitely look at the issue. But
are you able to make proper pledges or not? Because it's too
Well, I'm not making a pledge in that. No, it's not about edgy. You've got to look at how you make it work properly. Of course you've got to look at that. Look, I'm not diminishing Rupert Murdoch, right?
You should be diminished.
Yeah, but
diminish him down.
Yeah, okay, but he's much less powerful than he used to be. The British people have a lot more sense than some of these papers give them credit for.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but it's still a concern when you've like someone in Murdoch's power who's in it, like, because what it feels
and
like.
And you've got to be
us,
willing to stand up to these powerful forces, and I am.
Are you willing to?
Yeah.
The reason I have never voted in my life is because I think it don't matter which one. We all got excited about Tony Blair. We all got excited about Barack Obama. What happened?
Hang on a minute. Look, this is an important point. I'm not looking for euphoria, right? I know that sounds a bit weird. Obviously, you know, I want to get rid of the Tory government, and that's going to be a very good thing for the country. First of all, you don't want politicians saying, vote for me and on day one the world is transformed. It ain't going to be like that. Right? It ain't gonna be like that. Change is hard, right?
Yes.
Change takes time, and I'm not being a civil servant, I'm just saying that that's the reality. That's the first point. Secondly, you know, change happens not in a kind of, you know, it requires pressure, and it takes effort, and it takes people to demand the change to happen. So I'm not looking for euphoria, I'm looking for, you know, a sense of this is real, concrete, deliverable change. But I actually think that's what people want. I think that we're in a world where people are past the idea of, you know, this bloke comes along and he says, vote for Ed Miliband, and if you're, you know, if I'm in Downing Street on day one, life is kind of totally turned upside down. First of all, I don't think people want it. And secondly, I don't think people would believe it. I think people want, you know, kind of a sense that the country's run in a different way, that it's run for them again. I think the fundamental problem with this country is that people think it's run for somebody else, and the somebody else is probably somebody right at the top of society. They've got the access, the influence, the power, and it's not run for them. And that's what we've got to change.
That is exactly it. That is exactly it. What we need to feel, normal people, is that there is the will in politicians, that they're getting into politics not because of cronyism, not because of careerism, but because they want to represent ordinary people in the face of powerful elites that seem to somehow be beyond the grasp of ordinary politics, whether it's the financial sector, this sort of housing crisis that's going on in London, where it's before our eyes being socially cleansed of ordinary people, while towers, empty towers that are essentially money, never built to be lived in, are erected all over the place. There's a real sense that how is this happening? There's nothing we can do. And I completely agree with you, Ed. We don't want some sort of giddy, yes we can euphoria. We want a bloke who's going to say, look, I'm in this for the right reasons. I'm prepared to take on Murdoch. I'm prepared to take on HSBC. I'm prepared to take on the powerful elites that have got control of the Tory party, that if the Tory party were given any longer in charge of this country, could drive it into the ground, the very fabric of society itself being torn apart by them and the vested interests of powerful elites. I think people don't want euphoria at this time. I think people want security and stability and an end to that fear.
Yeah. Well, look, I agree with you that the prospect of another 5 years of the Tories is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
Incredibly dangerous for who the country works for. It's incredibly dangerous for the NHS. It's incredibly dangerous for, you know, I think their fundamental view is that the only way we succeed as a country is low pay, insecurity for most people. And, you know, the wealthiest get their tax cuts and the wealth trickles down to somebody else. And that's what we've got to change about the country. And we can change it. I think we need to encourage people to vote and be part of that change. Not on the basis, as you say, of giddy euphoria, but on the basis of things can be... Look, I've got a simple idea, which is Britain can be better. The Tories want to say, this is as good as it gets for the country. And this isn't as good as it gets for the country. This can't be as good as it gets for the country. And I think that is about where the stakes are.
So there we are. I think we learned a lot about Labour. We learned a lot about Ed Miliband. It's not a perfect interview, but personally I found it a very interesting experience. And I think it says a lot about Ed Miliband that he understands the way that media works now, the way that the country feels at the moment, the way that people feel, that he was prepared to come around here and talk to us at the Trues. Trues Politics Week continues. Tomorrow we're talking to the Greens. We're going to be talking to Natalie Bennett and Caroline Lucas. We go to them. They are women. Politeness does mean something in Britain today. I'm just a normal guy from Essex. Watch the Trues tomorrow. Politics Weeks continues.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with a further analysis of the neck and neck elections underway in the UK.
And it says here, we should be proud that we are free. And our free press reflects our democracy. Those praying voices on the right of the house are echoed down the street of shame. where politics mix with bingo and tits in a money and numbers game, where they offer you a feature on stockings and suspenders next to a call for stiffer penalties.
Don't need to change, the future's ours. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. He has an article in The Conversation, The Greens Are Not a Real Party of the Left. Here's Why. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And a minute ago, Toby, we just played a clip of the interview that Russell Brand did with Ed Miliband, the leader of the Labour Party, who's running for Prime Minister. And I played it largely, not that our audience necessarily cares that much about British politics, but rather as an example of what we don't have over here, which is a vigorous exchange between a sort of populist, anti-establishment anarchist, and an establishment candidate who's one of the two people likely to become the next leader of the United Kingdom. I can't imagine any American politician allowing themselves to be interviewed by Russell Brand or his American equivalent, if there's such a person. So what was your take on the interview?
I guess the closest thing would be if you had the late George Carlin interviewing somebody live. And having said that all politics is bunk, that would be the closest thing I could think of from the past. But of course, Brand is different in that he is still relatively young and he has a hip street aspect to his life and his way of operating that is very appealing. Brand, who is known mostly in the US, of course, as being a film actor, here is originally as having been one of the MTV VJs on British television at the time of the turn of the century, and then going on to be a radio show host, quite outrageous in many ways, and a sort of stand-up comedian, in addition to his later film acting, has come out very significantly.
And by the way, married to Katy Perry, I think. You're missing
it. He was for a time married to Katy Perry, that's right. But he came out very significantly in the last 12 to 18 months as a force of a kind of leftist anarchism, one that was extremely skeptical about the value of politics with a capital T, basically saying there's no point in voting and adopting a position that's been denounced by many as essentially nihilistic, you know, not being prepared to engage in any kind of reformism, not being prepared to see parliamentary or congressional politics as legitimate or in any way speaking with the voice of the people or addressing their needs. Now, he has a wildly popular TV video show that he has up on his own website, The Truths, and Ed Miliband came on that and spoke for a quarter of an hour, I guess it was, in a way that is easy to find cringeworthy. UK politician wearing suit, in this case with his jacket off, but with his tie done up, sitting on a couch next to Russell Brand, who's swigging down bottled water and laughing and so on, and trying to make a defense for the legitimacy and the significance of politics and the possibility of the needs of ordinary people being met against the needs of capital. I mean, essentially, that's what it's about. And sure, Miliband is somewhat embarrassing and no doubt embarrassed. But as you say, at least he's making an attempt, he's making an effort, he's opening himself up to be available to the kind of disenchantment that so many young people have with British politics and with US politics and addressing their concerns. Because like it or not, people like Russell Brand have managed to encapsulate that sense of alienation from the political process that is very profound in this country as it is in the US.
And Russell Brand has about 10 million Twitter followers. So how's it working? Because the mainstream press and the Tories, of course, are just lampooning Miliband, particularly for him sort of trying to speak with a kind of street slang.
Well, there's a moment when Ed Miliband's North London adenoidal tones are rather overcome by his desire to sound as though he's from the East End of London, complete with all the best glottal stops and so on that we associate with Russell Brand. Those linguistic differences may not mean terribly much in the US, but they mean a great deal here. And there's a particular accent that's known here, not as Cockney, but Mockney. Mockney being the notion of the middle class, the sound as though they're born within the sound of Bow Bells and are authentic proletarian London subjects. It's easy to make fun of that, but I change my voice when I sound a bit more austere when I'm talking to you, Ian, because I want to be one of the boys like you. Why shouldn't Ed Miliband?
Well, let's turn to British politics then, because it's clearly neck and neck at this point, and we're literally 1 week away from the election. The Greens could be very significant in this upcoming election in the United Kingdom, because Cameron and Miliband, the Labour and the Conservatives, are neck and neck, so the election could be swung in a number of directions. At this point, what are they polling?
They're only polling at about 5%, 6%, but what's interesting about them is that they are taking votes away from both the left, the Social Democratic Party, the Labour Party, and also the centre-left and centre-right in the Liberal Democrats. And the Liberal Democrats are currently in coalition with the Conservative Party in government. The difficult thing for the Greens is that there's no system of proportional representation or anything like it in Britain. It's all first past the post in these elections, unlike, say, in local government elections here or in the European elections. So right now they have only one member of the House of Commons, which is the equivalent of the House of Representatives in the United States, out of several hundred. And it's not even clear that their current leader, who is an Australian former journalist with The Guardian, a newspaper many people may know, Natalie Bennett, will win. She's standing in the electorate where I live, actually, in London.
Well, it's interesting that an Australian journalist should be heading up the British Green Party, since the Australians are headed by a former Brit known as Tony Abbott, who's considered recently by Foreign Policy magazine as the worst leader in the world.
He also has the worst comb-over in the world. But for sure, Abbott is clearly an appalling figure. We've seen just recently in Australia the federal government funding to the tune of millions of dollars climate change denial scholars at the University of Western Australia, for example. And he's an extremely reactionary figure. Bennett is a very interesting person, as are many of the Green politicians. They've got lots of very good policies. But unfortunately, their basic appeal is to the white middle class and to university students. They actually have less racial diversity in their parliamentary candidates than is the case of the far-right party, which is called UKIP, or the United Kingdom Independence Party. Nevertheless, in terms of party political membership, they've had an extraordinary surge over the last 4 months when they've added tens of thousands of fee-paying members. So there is a real urgency and sense of commitment that the Greens have. But as is often the case, they're not getting serious media treatment. They're either regarded as dangerous leftists or as comical fantasists because of their anti-economic growth perspective. And in my view, they fail to have the kind of grassroots social movement connection that you get with Syriza or Greece or Podemos in Spain. And as a consequence, they end up being hippies meet leftists, and without a real intellectual core. The great thing about those political parties is that they sprung up very quickly through alliances between very ordinary people, not, you know, Renton activists, and very, very well-qualified, rational academics. And that connection just doesn't really exist in British politics in the same way it doesn't exist in US politics.
Well, I think the Green Party in this country fits that definition of leftists and hippies, and it's gone down in its numbers, and it's become irrelevant since Ralph Nader. But, of course, Ralph Nader is infamous for having swung the 2000 elections in Florida to George W. Bush. that's not the case with under a parliamentary system in England. You know, even if it is first past the post, you still have the opportunity to form coalitions if nobody has a full majority. So that's where the Greens become relevant. And I understand that the extraordinary upsurge in party membership to the Green Party has a lot to do with this election video that they've done that's incredibly popular, that spoofs boy bands and these white male wet politicians like Cameron and Miliband.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, one of the interesting things about this election is that the so-called minor parties, Plaid Cymru, which is the Welsh Nationalist Party, the Scottish Nationalist Party, and the Greens, are all led by women. And when it's come to the big leaders debates, there have been numerous leadership debates on TV with many more participants than obviously we have in the presidential elections in the US, although a bit more like when you see the individual contests for nomination within the different political parties. In these debates between the Prime Minister, David Cameron of the Conservatives, Ed Miliband, the leader of the opposition, the Labour Party, and the other parties, the women have been enormously successful, particularly Nicola Sturgeon, who leads the Scottish Nationalists. But Plaid Cymru and the Greens have also done very, very well indeed. And so one aspect of the Greens' success is rather like that of these splinter nationalist parties, namely that the boys have mucked everything up, they've made a mess of everything. Let's have some women involved. And the other interesting thing is that there is an intellectual alliance as well as a gender alliance, in that all these parties, Scottish Nationalists, Plaid Cymru and the Greens, are anti-austerity. They're opposed to cutbacks, which many regard, of course, as simple redistribution of income upwards to the wealthy classes in politics. They're in favour of expanding the public sector and in favour of redistribution of income downward. So they represent a really significant alternative to business as usual, because in the case of the Scottish Nationalists, they're predicted to take dozens of seats away from the Labour Party in Scotland. The Conservatives are basically dead in the water in Scotland. They could really be deal breakers. And if things are really tight, and if the Greens win some unexpected seats, then they too could be deal breakers. We could be seeing an ongoing period of coalition electoral politics in this country of a kind that has never really been seen here on a consistent basis in the last 80 years, and very rarely in the history of UK politics at all. So in that sense, the Greens are part of a significant movement when it comes to gender, when it comes to anti-austerity politics, and when it comes to coalition building.
And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and he has an article in The Conversation, The Greens Are Not a Real Party of the Left, Here's Why. And we're talking about the Greens polling at 5% in the British elections, which, as Toby Miller just pointed out, could end up with but would all of these small parties, with the Scottish Nationalists and the Greens and the Welsh Party and Labour, wouldn't that be a natural fit? Or would they be like Nick Clegg and the Liberal Democrats, who threw their lot in with the Conservatives? I mean, how much is this ideology, and how much is this opportunism?
One of the interesting things at the moment is that the Tory Party, the Conservatives, equivalent of the Republicans, are painting a picture in which the Scottish Nationalists and the Labour Party form either a sort of grace and convenience arrangement whereby the Scottish Nationalists support the Labour Party in votes of confidence and also in the passing of the budget, or a full-scale coalition. And their argument, the Tory argument, is that the Scottish Nationalists want to remove Scotland from the United Kingdom, to break up the Union. Listeners may recall that we spoke about a referendum that was held in Scotland only a few months ago, in which the Scottish Nationalists' position was roundly defeated, 55-45%. But ever since, the Tories in particular have tried to speak in very nationalistic English ways. They've given up on any winning seats in Scotland, and basically they've said, we don't want all these people up north mucking around with our budgets and without actually being interested in being part of the Union. And so what they're arguing to a lot of swinging voters is, if you vote for the Labour Party, then what you're voting for is the breakup of the Union. So the Labour Party is jumping up and down and saying, we don't want coalitions, we're not interested in binding ourselves to any kind of arrangement with the Scottish Nationalist Party, they're our foes. And nobody knows what's going on in what used to be smoke-filled rooms in terms of deals that are being done. Should we win? Should we lose? Should we come second? And so on. The Lib Dems, the party that Clegg leads, which you mentioned, he's the Deputy Prime Minister. He may even lose his own seat in the House of Commons. There are several polls suggesting that he will. Their party is at the moment saying that they will consider a coalition with anybody who wins the most seats, even though there'll probably be no overall majority. But it's quite possible that the SNP, the Scottish Nationalists, will hold a significantly greater number of seats. So it is a very, very interesting moment, an interesting time in politics. Miliband is the son of Ralph Miliband, the famous Marxist, who was himself, of course, a noted Jewish refugee from the Holocaust who fought for Britain in the Second World War. And his brother, David Miliband, is a non-government organization think tank boss in New York. He defeated David for the leadership of the party. They're a very, very high-powered and impressive family, but he's not exactly a charismatic politician. David Cameron, who is a distant relative of the Queen of England, is very much a public relations machine guy, and both of them are advised by people who work for the President of the United States, Barack Obama. Obama's people have fingers in every pie. They're there moment by moment, but being paid a lot of money to do long-distance electioneering for both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. And the strategy is very much as per the Obama one, namely local community organizing, which is the old Chicago model, where you go around and you target the marginal constituencies, the seats that might swing. You find out exactly what people in the swinging parts of those electorates want by door knocking. You go back to your central administrators and say, this is what the focus groups are telling us. This is what your man or woman on the hustings needs to emphasize in their election speeches. So what we're seeing is, in a sense, a new variation on U.S. presidential politics, an attempt to utilize the Obama model, which wasn't really presidential. It was very much about door knocking and targeting specific parts of the country in order to get the required number of electoral college votes and applying that to a popular House of Representatives style House of Commons election here. So that's the other very interesting factor. First of all, coalition building and breaking. And secondly, the application of the Chicago movement organizer model from the Obama people to both the leading political parties here.
But clearly the Tories are exaggerating Scottish Nationalists and Labour forming a destructive and divisive coalition that would split up the country. That's conjecture. But what is fact is that if Cameron gets elected, then you will have a vote on Britain getting out of the European Union.
Well, that's right. Cameron has promised an important vote on the European Union at a referendum level. This is a repeat of what was done in the mid-1970s. It would be a comprehensive disaster for this country if it left the European Union. It's thanks to the massive size of the EU as a consumer market, the fact that it's a very effective and efficient customs union, the fact that it allows a very competent working class and middle class mobility at the labor level across borders that brings a great deal, a very great deal of the affluence to this country, which for all that it might feel like a post-imperial hangover place is somewhere that is still, you know, almost as large as the Californian economy. So it's a pretty big deal. And EU membership is absolutely crucial. It's something the left and the right have been divided over basically since Britain joined the European Union, or the European Economic Community as it then was in 1973. But for big business, it would be insanity to leave. And the Conservatives, as always, are split in a remarkable way between a kind of little Englander, racist, xenophobic patriotism, idiotic nationalism of the kind we associate in particular with the Republicans in the United States, and on the other hand, the reasonably rational, sensible, level-headed norms of big business, where they want reliability, certainty, minimization of risk, and maximization of markets, which is exactly what the EU gives them. So very much like we see in the United States. On the one hand, the Republicans are the party of big business. On the other, they're the party of mad people.
Well, but the mad people could win the vote in the UK to get out of Europe?
They certainly could, because UKIP, which is this other marginal party, which has at the moment just two members of the House of Commons, both of whom are defectors from the Conservative Party, is polling roughly 13 to 15%, though the trend is somewhat downwards. It is basically a single-issue party. We hate everybody whose name isn't Miller or Masters. We don't want them in our country, and we don't want to be a member of the EU. If they got a number of seats when to form a coalition with the Tories, then when allied to the fact that the Tories have well over 150 of what are called Eurosceptics, namely people within the Conservative Party who don't see value in being a member of the EU, then we could see an unholy alliance within the House of Commons that would form a very, very powerful voting bloc encouraging the public to vote against continuing membership of the EU. And there are some on the far left who are just as nationalistic and idiotic as these people who also are opposed to the EU. People like you and me, Ian, who remember what Britain was like in the 60s and 70s and what a flat, homogeneous and fundamentally dull society it was, will recall that it's become a much, much better place since we've seen an influx of people from the Commonwealth of Nations, from South Asia, from the Caribbean, from Africa, and also from Western and nowadays Eastern and Central Europe. It's a dynamic and exciting place by contrast with the homogeneity of WASPism that was so dominant all those years ago. But sadly, it is entirely possible that there will be a referendum, and of course, it's a 50-50 shootout under those circumstances. And the forces of xenophobia may well be effective in a country that has seen almost no significant alternative to the politics of austerity provided by the opposition, by the Social Democrats, by the Labour Party, and who may not be, for various reasons, prepared to vote for the Greens. So what you're seeing is a white working class that is disenfranchised and very angry and ripe for the picking in terms of the kind of xenophobia that can go with small-minded nationalism.
Well, just in closing, Toby Miller, one of the issues in this campaign between Ed Miliband, as you pointed out, he has this great family pedigree, and he refers to himself as a Jewish atheist, but he's basically taking on Cameron, and more or less saying that Cameron has presided over a Great Britain that's become irrelevant in the world, and that the Brits weren't even invited to the summit to deal with the Ukraine crisis, that it was the French and the Germans and Putin, and that Britain has become an irrelevant power under Cameron. So is that playing? I mean, obviously, Germany has assumed the role of leadership in Europe somewhat reluctantly, but it's happening. And Britain is, I mean, it's going to be downsizing its military to the point where it'll be pretty irrelevant too.
Well, there is certainly an ongoing jingoism that sees Britain as punching above its weight. That kind of cliche is used all the time. There is a lot of drum beating about how close one can get to the United States. It's still referred to as a special relationship here, even though in the US, decreasing numbers of people know what that's supposed to mean. The fact that both parties are using Obama's people as consultants is an index of how highly he's regarded. But certainly, they are having to cut back on their expenditure in certain areas. That said, they maintain what the French call the force de frappe, you know, their nuclear deterrent. They are expending billions of pounds on the Trident missile systems renewal, something that only the Greens effectively have opposed. And that's bipartisan. The Labour Party and the Tories would both do that. Every now and then, the Labour Party tries to make some hay over the notion of resurrecting a grandiose position in geopolitics. But basically, what they realize they are is geopolitically lackeys of the United States, who are lucky enough, because of the extraordinary graft and corruption of the British financial system, to be bankers to corrupt oligarchs from around the world, and that's how we remain an affluent society.
Well, on that note, I sympathize with you living in London and having to compete with Russian oligarchs for real estate. But that's also the case, by the way, in New York. I thank you for joining us, Toby Miller.
Always great to talk to you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. And he has an article in The Conversation, The Greens Are Not a Real Party of the Left. Here's why. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into the shakeup at the top of Saudi Arabia's ruling family. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Lacey, who's a British historian and the author of numerous international bestsellers, among them Majesty, The Kingdom, A Study of Saudi Arabia, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from English History. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Lacey.
Thank you, Ian.
And there's been a fairly substantial shakeup at the very top of the leadership inside Saudi Arabia, which means, of course, inside the Saudi Al Saud family. The long-serving foreign minister, Prince Saud Al Faisal, who has been basically in charge of the kingdom's foreign policy for nearly four decades, he's been replaced by the U.S. ambassador here, a young, not a royal, Adel Al Jubayr. And then you've got, of course, the Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, the powerful interior minister. He's now been named next in line to the Saudi throne. And then, of course, Prince Merkan, the former king's son, he's out. And then, of course, we know that he's named his son, the king's named his son, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, as deputy crown prince. And he's also the defense minister, is he not?
He is the defense minister, and he is the most intriguing character in this list of reshuffled individuals you've just mentioned. He's young. He may be as young as 30, maybe 35. And the reason for his elevation has a lot to do with the age of his father, King Salman. Sorry to teach an elephant to suck eggs or whatever. Whenever you hear the word bin in the name of an Arab, it means son of. So he is Mohammed bin Salman, Mohammed the son of Salman, the youngest of Salman's many sons, who has become important in the last 5 or 6 years as his father has ailed to some degree by providing, in a way, the mental horsepower, certainly the physical horsepower, that King Salman needs. As governor of Riyadh, which he was until 5 or 6 years ago, he would receive endless petitions by petitioners who would come to him under the Saudi system of democracy, whereby anybody can see their king or their governor, or I say any man can go and sit with the king or governor and discuss problems and give him problems. And so at the end of any one of these meetings, the prince in question, there are 13 who govern Saudi Arabia in different provinces, there are the ministers, not apart from the king and the crown prince, is left with a great pile of papers, 130, 140 petitions from citizens, which have to be dealt with. And King Salman took this sort of thing very seriously, and he discovered that his young son, Mohammed, liked nothing more than sitting down in front of these piles of paper and dealing with them. Somebody said to me, you know, show Mohammed bin Salman a pile of papers and he will sit down and he won't get up until every single one has been dealt with. The citizens would come back a week later. Something would have been done. And thus the prince's life, now the king's life, was made easier. So And there are rumours that King Salman may have Alzheimer's, may have dementia. I don't believe those are true. It's certainly true that towards the end of the day, he flags somewhat mentally. And so this young man has become an extension of him. And that is why he has his very important post of defence minister and now has been given this place in the succession. This, of course, tells us nothing about the young man's intelligence or young man's capacity to wage a very complicated war, which is what faces Saudi Arabia at the present and for the foreseeable future in Yemen.
Well, but clearly, Robert Lacey, I mean, the one thing that's been pointed out about the king's son, and the youngest son of that, who you just described, is that he was not educated abroad, as most of the Saudi princes, and certainly the top ones in the government. And that's been sort of reported as being a deficiency. How would you describe it?
Well, it could be a deficiency. We don't know. I mean, I think all we can say is that it's pretty clear that unless he makes some terrible mistakes, so long as King Salman remains on the throne, his son's position as deputy crown prince is secure. He might, in fact, though, get removed by the successor king. I mean, that is what has triggered this reshuffle. Until the other day, the situation was that King Salman was due to be succeeded by his half-brother, Prince Mughrin bin Abdulaziz, the last of the sons of Abdulaziz, the great founder, creator of Saudi Arabia, who named the country after himself and his family. And the reason why King Salman has removed him, which, as I say, might happen in the future to his own son by a future king, is because Salman felt the time had come for younger blood to come into the mainstream of the Saudi royal family. They're always getting criticized for being a collection of geriatrics. If Mughrin, the king's half-brother, had remained to become king in succession to King Salman, he would have reigned for another 10, 12 years or so, meaning that the really crucial figure in what we're talking about, Mohammed bin Naif, who's now been made the full crown prince, would have been had to wait to become king for more than a decade. And Mohammed bin Naif, again, Mohammed, son of Naif, a former interior minister of the kingdom, is the man that people certainly in America and in Saudi Arabia view as an incredibly important character. He's led the fight against terrorism. He himself was in a rather dramatic way nearly the victim of a terrorist who managed to get into his presence on the pretext that he had reformed, become a new man, wanted to meet the prince to thank him for his help in his redemption. And then the moment he got into the prince's presence, pressed a button and exploded a bomb that was literally inside himself. He pushed it up inside himself. And the man himself was splattered all over the room. Somebody who saw this after the event said there was an arm hanging from the chandelier when he went in. And Mohammed bin Naif miraculously survived this with only a slight scratch because the man had pushed this explosive up inside his pelvic girdle, which directed the blast down and up, but not sideways. And so, quite apart from his undoubted abilities, his great ability to speak English, his closeness to the Americans, Mohammed bin Naif is regarded rather magically by ordinary Saudis as a man who's destined for this job now as crown prince and after Salman as the future king.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Lacey, who's a British historian and the author of numerous international bestsellers, among them Majesty, The Kingdom, A Study of Saudi Arabia, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from English History. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. And Mohammed bin Naif, of course, is in contrast to King Salman's son, the defence minister, in as much as he's, you know, educated abroad, very familiar with the international scene, and as you mentioned, highly regarded in the US. I think he was also, wasn't he also his father used to be the intelligence head as well, didn't he?
And he was his deputy. That's right, intelligence. Yeah. And I would just say this, Ian, you know, you're saying, and I hear where you're coming from, and I'm sure your listeners are coming from there, well, we're a bit worried about this guy who's never been educated outside Saudi Arabia talking about the young Mohammed bin Salman. Let me tell you, it's exactly the opposite in Saudi Arabia. There is great suspicion of Western education, great anger that the fact that the government sends 150,000 of its finest students at any one time to countries like America to get a Western education. You know, this is the problem in the Middle East, the whole of the Middle East, the great mistrust of the West, what the West has done to the Middle East, the invasion of Iraq, the invasion of Libya, when Western armies have gone in with our fine ideas about human rights and putting things to rights and, you know, getting more Western ideas in, and the result has been chaos, and we have just, of course, have walked away when it hasn't worked. So there's a great groundswell in Saudi Arabia, as in every other Arab country in the Middle East, against this idea that the West has the secrets. So the fact that this young prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is Saudi educated, will certainly in his own country do a lot for his credibility and for the credibility of his father as well.
Well, apparently the war that he's prosecuting in Yemen is extremely popular in Saudi Arabia. They're going through a kind of flush of patriotism, which is not unlike, I imagine, what we lived through here in the United States when George W. Bush and Dick Cheney took us into that ill-advised war in Iraq. And your point is well taken, because my understanding is that the Saudis are frankly frustrated with the Americans, that they were very disappointed about what happened or what didn't happen in Syria when Assad crossed the red line on using chemical weapons. And in general, a lot of analysts are saying that what they're doing in Yemen is like, you know, okay, we're sick of following your lead, the United States. We're going to do things on our own. And that's a big break from what most analysts I talk to say.
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right, Ian. And of course, Saudi will also say to you, you know, for decades you've been telling us to step up to the plate and do something ourselves. Now we're doing it. Because let's not forget, this is not just Saudi Arabia getting involved in Yemen. It's a carefully coordinated joint attack by the Arab monarchies as a whole, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Qatar, countries that have in the recent past not really been able to get their act together. And rather impressively, at least in outset, they have worked together to try and stem the advance of this populist movement known as the Houthis, who are certainly Shia Muslims, which of course means a great deal to the Sunni kingdoms. Whether or not Iran is really so involved in what the Houthis are doing as the Saudis allege is another issue. But as I'm sure your listeners have heard, the elected president of Yemen was first chased down to the little port of Aden on the Red Sea coast. And President Hadi was compelled to take refuge in Riyadh. And really, the Saudis had no choice. What could they do? Just stand back and let these people take over? As you rightly say, Ian, it's been a very popular war so far. Even people who, you know, who tweet critically against the House of Saud, who are Arabs, say, no, this far and no further, we're doing the right thing.
Well, at this point, we don't know how it's going to play out. But how does Saudi Arabia, though, deal with the fact that it's got a Shia minority population in its oil-rich, the oil fields on the Gulf? My understanding is it also has 25% of the population living in poverty. Would that be in that same area? Are the Shia in Saudi Arabia the most impoverished group?
There's no doubt at all that the Shia population who live in the eastern province And of course, ironically, right alongside the oil fields that produce the country's wealth, feel excluded from the Saudi consensus as a whole. And it's not got any better recently as Sunni-Shia tensions have heightened across the region. Here again, the House of Saud is sort of sandwiched. I've been to the eastern province. I've been to Shia villages and talked to Shia. I've got Shia friends there. There's no doubt at all that they fear the mistrust and anger of their Sunni fellow citizens. And the House of Saud has to walk a rather difficult line protecting the rights of its Shia. There's no doubt if the House of Saud weren't there as a buffer, you would see the sort of inter-sectarian violence you've seen in other countries across the region, the dreadful slaughter that's gone on in Iraq and Syria as well. So what's going on in Yemen certainly doesn't help that at all. I mean, now, until now, the House of Saud and the Saudi, and Saudi Arabia as a whole have looked to the east and looked to the north at the Shia threat. They now see it in the south as well.
And they seem to be quite paranoid about Iran in general, obviously, being the leading Shia nation. And they seem to be extremely unsettled by this potential deal between the P5+1 and Iran, which, you know, the U.S. Senate now has some say in, which may scuttle at this end. We don't know. Although the president can veto anything that they're now starting, the senators, particularly this Marco Rubio that's running for president, is now insisting on putting in amendments saying that the Iranians have to recognize Israel, which, of course, is a non-starter. So we don't know how that's going to work out. But it does raise an interesting kind of irony, doesn't it, that you have Saudi Arabia, the Republicans in the House and Senate, and Israel all against this deal.
Yes, I'd be cautious about wondering whether the Saudis would go as far as the senator you're mentioning in wanting to scuttle the deal. The House of Saud has been involved in the past in trying to mend bridges with Iran. There are some things they have to say for public consumption. And I know from speaking to senior Saudi princes that they would like some sort of resolution of this dreadful, lethal conflict between Sunni and Shia in the area, and that they're not averse to coming to some sort of deal with Iran. But you're quite right. They're anxious. They're anxious at the prospect that Iran will in some way become a nuclear power with the capacity to threaten them. And that is why they've been cultivating their links with Pakistan. It's often said maybe the Saudis have bought a nuclear weapon off the shelf from Pakistan already, or have access to that. We just don't know. Just like we don't know, officially, we don't know that Israel has got nuclear weapons. They're not supposed to have any nuclear weapons. They don't admit it. Maybe the Saudis are just like the Israelis, that they've already taken the precautions they need for the future. But certainly, and you talk about paradoxes, Ian, this policy does represent a step away from the United States in some ways. On the other hand, they are coordinating what they're doing on the ground in Yemen very closely with the United States, which has warships in the area. And this brings us to the last element of this reshuffle you mentioned right at the beginning. The new foreign minister, Adel Joubert, non-royal, has been the Saudi ambassador in Washington for many years, speaks perfect English. You couldn't have a man who is better plugged in to the Washington establishment. He will know all these senators you're talking about and will have close relationships with them. And so, again, another aspect of this reshuffle in Saudi Arabia is, yes, partly assertion of Saudi power, but also making sure that Saudi Arabia stays right on side with America, because now the new crown prince, Mohammed bin Naif, and the foreign minister, Adel Joubert, are two characters who know America well and are well known by America and well trusted by the power brokers in Washington.
Well, just in closing, Robert Lacey, what was not or little noticed in the announcements that came out on Wednesday of this big reshuffle at the top of the Saudi Arabian royal family in terms of the leadership and these important portfolios. Noura Al-Fayez, who was Saudi Arabia's first female minister and the most senior woman in government, and she was working on trying to improve women's education, and she also obviously attracted the hostility of the Mutawa, the religious police, or the conservatives in general. She's just been sacked. So lots of criticism about Saudi Arabia's treatment of women. They can't drive cars, etc. This certainly looks like a step backwards.
Yes and no, Ian. And I must praise you for your attention to detail, because this is a highly significant part of what's happened. It's a straightforward step by King Salman to appease the conservatives who were furious at the work that Noura Fayez was doing to try and encourage particularly physical education for young Saudi women. I mean, it seems absolutely mad to us, not to say immoral, but I'm afraid it's the sort of battleground on which in Saudi Arabia the fights are fought out between progressives and conservatives. And I would say that King Salman has retreated on this, the better to advance in the future. His predecessor, King Abdullah, went to his grave vilified by the conservatives of Saudi Arabia for his attempts to push women forward in the public arena. He named 30 women to the Saudi Consultative Assembly, assembly of 150. So in fact, ironically, that there is a higher proportion of women in the Saudi parliament than there is in the Senate in the United States. That's by the fiat of the previous king. But it absolutely infuriated the conservatives, and a rift had developed between the king and his progressive advisors around him and the conservatives. And when we look to the future of the Middle East, where threats to these Arab monarchies, the only stable regimes left in the region along with Israel, the threats are likely to come from the sort of spirit that animates ISIS, the fundamentalist mistrust of the West that we've discussed earlier. And so Salman's tactic, unlike his previous predecessor and half-brother Abdullah, is not to antagonize the conservatives, but for the moment get them on side and then see about things in the future.
Well, Robert Lacey, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Lacey, who's a British historian and the author of numerous international bestsellers, among them Majesty, The Kingdom, A Study of Saudi Arabia, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from English History. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.